This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri, in for Bob Kinzel. If you're a news junkie in Vermont, this was a great week to be alive. Before you could hide away your holiday decorations or wear that new sweater that your Aunt Sylvia got for you, it was time to get back to Montpelier for the second biennium of the legislative session. Once there, the Senate heard testimony about whether to suspend Franklin County Senator Norm McAllister. Then Governor Peter Shumlin had his chance to lay out his priorities for his final go-around during the State of the State address. Ah, but the cherry on top might have been last night's landing of Trumpapalooza in Burlington. Republican presidential candidate Donald J. Trump gave a campaign speech at the Flint Center for the Performing Arts. We'll talk about these stories and look ahead at what we can expect in the next few months in Montpelier. And here to dissect all this delicious news fodder is an esteemed panel of Vermont reporters. Anne Galloway is founder and editor of vtdigger.org. Dave Graham is a reporter for the Associated Press based in Vermont. And Paul Heintz is political editor and columnist for 7 Days. And Dave, Paul, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thanks
for having us.
Glad to do it.
For reporters, this is the equivalent of a Thanksgiving dinner, so we're going to get started. But please leave room for second and third helpings. We're going to begin with Donald Trump's visit to the Flint Center last night. Getting into Flint last night was a little bit of an adventure. Paul, you were there. What was the mood inside the theater last night?
Well, as you say, just getting in was a real stretch for people. Some started lining up at 4:30 in the morning. Most of the people I spoke to inside of the theater had been standing in line for hours and hours to get in there. You know, those who got into the theater appeared mostly to be Trump supporters, and there's a reason for that. Trump staffers were manning the doorways and actually asking people as they were coming in whether they supported him. Those who said they did not support him were turned away, and so it was mostly Trump supporters, although a fair number of opponents snuck in deviously, and some of those people protested. I counted about 9 separate interruptions during the course of about an hour and 10-minute speech. People would stand up and you know, try to shout Trump down. He would then shout them down, and they would be removed by security. He seemed to kind of revel in those encounters. And, you know, at one point he instructed security to take away a person's coat. He said it was 10 degrees below zero. He said, take away his coat. You know, we'll send it back in a couple of weeks. So it was really quite the scene inside.
It wasn't quite that cold outside, but
no, it really wasn't. Thank goodness for all those people in line.
That's right. Let's talk a little bit about that screening process. Used a vet who got in and who didn't. They were asked if they supported Trump, if they were neutral or said they were just going to learn about him. They were asked to leave. If they put up any kind of a fuss, I believe police, they were told police would escort them out or they would be arrested because it is a private event. Anne Galloway, is this something that, you know, other campaigns have taken this tactic? Have you heard about anything like this before?
This is unique as far as I know. I haven't heard of this kind of thing before. David, I don't know. Have you?
No, although, you know, I haven't had a lot of experience covering these visits by presidential candidates. We don't get a lot here in Vermont.
This is true.
I suppose it could have happened elsewhere, but you know, it was and some people were complaining about the sort of First Amendment implications of this last night. But, you know, it was a private venue and the Trump campaign had paid rent for it. So I suppose they have some say over who gets in and who doesn't. Obviously, there were some people who decided to get in by perhaps not being fully truthful about whom they were supporting in the campaign as they entered. They were able to voice some objections to what the candidate has been saying and was saying last night. So it was really quite a show, quite an event last night.
Well, speaking about the protest voice, Paul, there was a protest across the street organized at City Hall Park. So what was going on there?
Yeah, you know, there were a number of protests. There was a march down Church Street. There was protests in City Hall Park. There were people who were just standing across the barricades that lined Main Street and were hurling insults in the direction of the rally. You know, you saw really every conceivable type of protest yesterday. And there were a lot of people, I'm sure, who just decided to stay home as well, who didn't want to dignify the appearance with their adding their voices to it. So, you know, it was a uniquely Burlington event, I would say, and it was quite the spectacle.
The Trump campaign said they gave out 20,000 tickets. I don't know if that's ever really been verified, but that's what they told the city that they had done. The Flynn holds 1,400. And like we said, they kind of screen people. So basically, Donald Trump was preaching to the converted rather than trying to get his message out to a new audience. Ann Galloway, what kind of sense does that make to you?
Well, I think he was making a statement about Vermont to New Hampshire. He was making a statement to Sanders. You know, he had no qualms about coming into enemy territory and really caused a great spectacle in Burlington. And that was an accomplishment all by itself. I mean, just getting that news about the 20,000 Eventbrite tickets being distributed, that was carried by all the news outlets. It was mission accomplished probably for him. He generated a lot of buzz here in the state of Vermont. And whether he was preaching to the choir or not, we don't really know, because he reached an awful lot of people through the feed that came from the Burlington Free Press, too. So I think there were a lot of people watching here and around the country.
All right. Well, let's listen to just a little bit of what Donald had to say. I think we have that bite from him. Donald?
We're in Vermont. That air is so nice and clean. I'm breathing so much of that air. Thank you. That's so great. That is so great. It is true. I got here. I said, I just want to breathe that air. I went outside. There's like 20,000 people. We can't get them in. So you are very, very lucky tonight, I hope, right?
Not to rail on his accounting, but there weren't 20,000 people outside. As a matter of fact, Burlington
might have been rounding
chief,
up a little bit.
Yes, or added a zero. As a matter of fact, Burlington Police Chief Brenda Del Pozo said that the number was probably around 2,000 who had been waiting in line, not 20,000. It's a reporters' roundtable today on Vermont Edition. We've got a plethora of topics to discuss. Of course, we have the legislature reconvening, Donald Trump's campaign stop last night in Vermont. If you were there, we'd love to hear about the pageantry, the protests that you observed. What did you see or hear? Also, any questions you have for our panel, you can call now at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post them on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So this was really a private event, is what they told people as they came in. And it almost appeared to be then a made-for-the-media event. Trump speaks to a packed house of mostly his supporters. It kind of felt more Jerry Springer show than traditional campaign whistle-stop. Is that the feeling you got, Dave?
Well, I did. And it was, you know, as a piece of showmanship, it was a triumph. I mean, he was able to come into town and put on the show and have it basically go exactly as he wanted it. Frankly, he reminds me a little bit of Bill Maher, you know, the comedian, political commentator, has a show on HBO. And because, you know, they both frequently say things that are basically seem designed to be a bit outrageous or a lot outrageous. And they both have, you know, quite a bit of humor injected into their performance. I get the sense they don't like each other very much, certainly from what Maher says about Trump. And but they do have, you know, sort of a similar appeal, I think, in some ways, and obviously from different ends of the political spectrum. But, you know, of course, one difference is Maher's not running for president. But, you know, watching Trump last night, you just got the sense it was a stand-up act. It's sort of this stream of consciousness patter that seems to, you know, you see some comedians pull off, and he did that, and, you know, he had the audience rolling, and he was rolling with them, and you know, aside from the handful of interruptions by hecklers and so on, and who did get into it all, it was it seemed to be kind of a tour de force by this guy. And whether that's substantive politics or whatever of the kind people want to vote for, obviously that's to be decided later. But as a piece of showmanship, it seemed to work.
Paul, did you feel you were at a comedy routine or
I did.
At a,
that was exactly,
a reality show?
That's exactly how I would describe it. You know, what was interesting to me is that I've spent a lot of time, as many other Vermont reporters have this election cycle, covering Senator Sanders' presidential campaign. And, you know, both Sanders and Trump have been compared with one another by some of the national press because of their outsiders, sort of unexpected candidacies. But, you know, I couldn't imagine two more dissimilar speaking styles. Sanders typically will stand up there for an hour and he will just try to spend as much of that time focusing on policy as he possibly can. They can be pretty dense speeches. The most he talks about politics is disparaging the political process and disparaging those who focus too much on political polls and insults and gaffes and that kind of thing. And really, you know, Trump was quite the opposite. He spent, 20 minutes of his intro, it sounded like, was just talking about how well he was doing in the polls, you know, rattling off statistics about how awesome he was. And then, he went on to spend quite a bit of time just insulting every one of his opponents. You know, he kept on going after Jeb Bush as being no energy, Rand Paul as having done a quote, horrible job, Rick Perry as being brutal. You know, I mean, it's just like the dude was just standing up there just talking smack about people for most of the night. So it was really it was kind of a fascinating thing to watch.
And you've mentioned that he comes into Burlington, Vermont. So the richest vein of blue that you might find, progressive Burlington in navy blue Vermont. So why does he come here? Is it to tweak Bernie? Is it because the other candidates, as he mentioned, aren't coming here, the other Republican candidates? It's a tight race. Every delegate at the Republican convention could be important, even from Vermont. What do you think his motivation was?
Because he could.
That's true. He bought out the place.
Yeah. And I think it's a study in contrast, and he just kind of wanted to tweak us. And it's win-win for him. He gets to make fun of us and make fun of one of his opponents at the same time and play to the crowd in New Hampshire. Folks over there, are divided over Bernie and Clinton. And so who knows? But I think it's interesting that one thing the two candidates do have in common, Sanders and Trump, is that they have avoided the sort of airbrushed, managed communication that all the other candidates are tied up in. You know, people are so afraid to speak their minds on the campaign trail. And these are two guys who really aren't afraid of that. And they have very different motivations. They have very different styles. And one talks about himself and the other eschews that kind of self-promotion in a way. But their ability to just dive into straight talk without being afraid of what people think, that's refreshing, I think, to a lot of voters. And in a world where so much of what you see in the press is actually derived from press releases and from, material that campaigns want to get out there. People want authenticity, however it manifests, I think.
Dave Graham, why do we see him here?
I think going to Burlington was part of the act, basically. You know, it's like the clown going through the ring of fire or whatever, and he said, where would it be the most outrageous place for me to go? And Bernie Sanders' hometown? Sure, why not? Let's do it. And so I just think that was part of the show, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a great venue for the show he wanted to put on.
Listeners, you can join the discussion at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Let's hear from Caitlin, who's calling from Burlington. Caitlin, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a Bernie supporter and one of many who I'm horrified by Trump and his the fact that he's made it this far. I just find it absolutely it's a very upsetting. And I reserved tickets to last night's event and did not go as a strategy that many people, I think, did, specifically to not feed him and to not give him the attention that he came here looking for. And one of the things that I find really shocking is how much the media and the public are giving him this attention that he craves and that is feeding his campaign, and continuing to use his name and to have these conversations about this person. And he's, you know, he's winning the game that he came here to play. You know, the looking at media and the coverage that he got made it look as though, you know, he wins, that he got 20,000 people, and really there were 2,000 who actually went. And the pictures that show up, you know, there are a few protesters, but he did kind of, you know, win what he came here to do. And it's very frustrating that the media is being played so well, I think, by him.
Thanks, Caitlin. And let's hear from Vicky, who's calling from St. Johnsbury. Vicky, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
Well, hi. I just wondered what the panel thinks about whether Donald Trump really wants to be president or not, or if he's just trying to flush out the issues for the rest of the Republican candidates.
Sure. All right. That's a fantastic question. Let's put it first to Paul Heinz. What do you think?
I think that's a little bit above my pay grade. I mean, you know, he's certainly not acting the way that a conventional candidate acts. And so I think it's probably we have a tendency as those who watch and cover politics to discount him and to think he's not serious. And I think that there's been a lot of that throughout this cycle. And I think that's why we continue to be surprised when he does so well. You know, I would hesitate to try to get inside of that orange head of Donald Trump's. I don't know what's in there. I don't know what's motivating him. I thought the first caller raises a very important point, though. You know, he is a creature of the media, and I think he was here courting earned media from the national press, and he got it, and he got it from us. And it's true. We're all there. You know, we scrambled several reporters to cover it. But at the same time, you know, we kind of have to cover it because his showing up here and the support and the opposition that it generated was a very significant news story. So, you know, there's it's a difficult thing to balance, I think, as a media organization.
And Galloway, Vicky asks, does Donald Trump want to be president, or is he just promoting the Trump brand?
Well, it sure is a great way to market himself, isn't it? And he doesn't have to pay for it necessarily.
Right.
I mean, he says that he's self-funded, but he's also gotten support from billionaires for his campaign. So at the end of the day, he's going to come out making bank, and whether he wins the nomination or not. He's not the only presidential candidate that we've all covered who's come through. And whenever a presidential candidate comes to Vermont, we're all going to gravitate to that because we're trying to do our jobs, you know.
Dave, there definitely were Trump supporters in the Flynn last night.
Sure.
Whether people wanted to believe that they existed or not in Vermont, they exist. They were there. So what was it that resonated with him? What messages, you know, that he kind of put out there really resonated with his supporters last night at the Flynn?
Well, you know, I think that a lot of average Americans out there do feel disaffected and disconnected from power and the political processes in the country and the media processes in the country. And they sort of feel as though they essentially want to thumb their nose at the system. And some are doing that via supporting Bernie Sanders, who, you know, says he wants to upend the system, the political finance system, and is a constant critic of the mass media and so on. Others are doing that by saying, I'm going to vote for this guy who just comes across as kind of funny and outrageous and is maybe saying things that aren't polite to say or you're not supposed to say in polite company, but gee whiz, that's the attraction there to folks. And so, you know, for him to, as Paul said, talk smack about all of his political opponents and so on, does actually get a laugh from that crowd, and you know, is part of that whole sort of nose thumbing process. You know, it's just and it does feel powerful to especially a lot of people who've felt pretty powerless over the years, and so I think that's the appeal.
This is Vermont Edition. We're talking about the week that was in news with three of the top reporters in the state. You can join in the discussion. Next up, we're going to talk about Governor Shumlin's State of the State address. We'll also be talking about the Norm McAllister vote in the Senate. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Rick Singeri, and this is Vermont Edition. It's been big doings this week in Vermont news. There was something new in almost every news cycle, starting with reconvening the legislature in Montpelier all the way to Donald Trump's Flynn appearance last night. I'm joined by Paul Heintz. He is political editor and columnist for 7 Days, Anne Galloway, founder and editor of vtdigger.org, and Dave Graham, a reporter for the Associated Press. And listeners, you can join the conversation with your thoughts or questions. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Now, in his final State of the State address yesterday, Governor Shumlin outlined his priorities and also spoke about what he felt that his administration had accomplished. And at one point, he compared himself to longtime Vermont politician George Aiken, who served as a Republican governor in the late 30s.
It hasn't been easy, but together we have accomplished so much. Vermont is a better place to live. It's a better place to work. It's a better place to raise a family than it was when we began. Governor Aiken was forthright in saying, "There have been times when we have encountered rough places on the highway of our history," but he concluded, "We have been successful for the most part." Both are as true today as they were in Aiken's day.
That's Governor Shumlin from his State of the State address yesterday. I'm going to go around the horn and ask each of you, and you first, your overall impressions of the governor's speech yesterday.
Yes, well, I think the governor was essentially listing his accomplishments over the past three terms, and this was his last speech. You know, he announced that he wasn't going to be running for governor again back in June, and so it was kind of unusual in that this was almost like a farewell speech, and it was studded with some of his initiatives and build-outs of some of those initiatives that he hopes to carry over the finish line in the upcoming session. And, you know, I think there's kind of there's some open questions about whether or not he succeeded on some of these initiatives or not. And, you know, the Republicans took him to task for some of those things. Yeah, I think it was basically a victory lap.
Dave Graham?
I think he had a good deal of success to talk about. You know, he mentioned that Vermont's the only state in the country with universal pre-K education for 3- and 4-year-olds. That was something that happened during his tenure. I mean, obviously, these things aren't all the governor. You have to have the sometimes they originate in the legislature, frankly. But, you know, and he talked about the job growth. He talked about the lowering the number of people who are uninsured in the state down to, you know, he puts it almost zero. I mean, they used to say that 5% unemployment rate was effective zero unemployment, and we're down to 3-something in the uninsured category. So he certainly has had some successes. The big problem, and the Republicans were pointing this out yesterday too, though, is that there's still so much economic anxiety in Vermont. People who just have not seen their paychecks increase. Meanwhile, you know, property taxes go up and state fees go up, and you know, we added a couple of candy and soda, I think, to the sales tax. And so expenses are constantly going up and people's incomes are not. And that just creates so much tremendous anxiety out there. And the governor really did not spend much time in his speech yesterday on the economy at all. And, you know, I guess maybe there's a political reason for that a little bit. And, you know, obviously he wanted to tout his accomplishments since it is his final State of the State address. But I think a lot of people were kind of hoping he would have something to say that would, frankly, give them a little hope about. Mm-hmm. I mean, he mentioned some new jobs coming to St. Johnsbury, but give them a little hope about an overall lifting of the. And of course, Public Assets Institute was just out last week with a study talking about the growing income inequality gap in Vermont. And so there has been economic growth in Vermont, but an awful lot of it has gone to the upper echelons of. wealthy folks. So,
all right, Paul Hyatt, your takeaway?
Yeah, you know, I agree with both what Dave and Ann said. I think I was struck by the fact that you know, there wasn't a lot there. You know, there were certainly some new policy proposals, but nothing that really struck me as big and major. I think that in a way, Governor Shumlin and legislative Democrats are victims of their own success. They have held power now for 5 years, and they have accomplished quite a bit. So there's really not a whole lot on the to-do list going forward. So we heard some new ideas, but it was kind of a hodgepodge. And, you know, even some of the more striking proposals, such as legalizing marijuana and divesting from fossil fuels, were really couched in a lot of caveats. You know, this was not a full-throated call from Governor Shumlin to legalize pot. It was basically, we need to take a careful look at this, and here are some things that I'm going to keep in mind as I work with legislators on this. And likewise with divestment. It wasn't, we are divesting now from, you know, from coal and oil. It was a more careful approach. So, mm-hmm. You know, it seemed a little bit, I hate to quote Donald Trump, but a little bit low energy, as he's wont to say about Jeb Bush.
Yes, he does. Well, Paul, the governor did take a whack at Act 46, and he asked for a repeal or a moratorium on this education bill's spending caps. He'd like that done before town meeting day. So how will that request be received by the legislature?
Well, already it's not being received all that well by House Democrats. Dave Sharp, who chairs the House Education Committee, said, I don't think repeal is on the table. So, you know, it seemed at the very end of last year as if the governor and legislative leaders had reached some kind of an agreement on this to address it at the start of the session. And they haven't. And that's very striking to me because right now, of course, every municipality in the state is trying to finish off its budget. School districts are trying to determine whether they need to cut more. And so if a fix or a delay or a repeal or whatever, it doesn't happen until March, that's going to be a real problem for many, many local officials. So I have to say I'm a little bit surprised that that there is not more consensus at this point. I don't know how long these negotiations will last or in what form, but it's certainly going to be people are going to be hearing from their constituents on this.
And Galloway, you think he's going to get what he asked for on Act 46 by town meeting day?
I don't know if it'll be by town meeting day or not, but I know the Senate supports his, you know, that they're supportive of a repeal or a moratorium. In the House, they're looking at raising the cap a little bit. They're looking at a tweak. And we had a story this week about how that tweak wouldn't even help. You know, a third of the districts in the state, more than 100 districts, would end up having to pay penalties even with a 0.9% increase in the cap. So it's really a conundrum, and it comes down to whether or not House Ed, and especially Dave Sharp, is willing to relent on that. And I think there is a lot of concern in the House about property taxes, which have continued to go up at the same time that student enrollments have declined. And they wanted to do something to show voters that they had worked on this issue. And so I think a lot of them have a personal commitment to that. And if they aren't able to achieve savings right away, I think that they feel that they're going to face a lot of pressure back home.
Now, another thing that the governor proposed was the Step Up program, which would give support services and a free semester of courses to low-income Vermonters and others. Dave Graham, what's he hoping to accomplish with this, and is there support for it?
I do think there's a sense, you know, Vermont has a very high high school graduation rate, but a comparatively low continuation rate for kids who get out of school and continue on to college or vocational training and that kind of thing. And so you do have an awful lot of young Vermonters in the 18 to 25-year-old age bracket who are, frankly, out there kind of floating around in sort of lower wage and often kind of they feel dead-end jobs. And, you know, they're sort of looking around and saying, how am I going to get my life on track and started and on some kind of a career track that's going to – you know, it used to be decades ago, you'd go out and you'd get a manufacturing job out of high school, and you'd work your way up through the union raises or through the ranks of the management of the company or whatever, and eventually become successful that way, and or at least get into the middle class. And that seems closed off to a lot of young people in Vermont, particularly those at the lower income level whose families perhaps don't have the money to send them to college right off. I think what the governor's trying to do here, I mean, people were commenting yesterday that, you know, paying for classes to basically equal to one semester at a state college is not going to get you even, you know, that's a quarter way to an associate's degree, and what do you do about the other three semesters?
Right.
But I think what he really wants to do is to get a lot of these young people on a track where they're thinking about, you know, I can handle college level work. I like this. I like the idea of getting myself further educated and perhaps onto a career track. And so, I think he's trying to promote that kind of an idea because right now there is just a lot of frustration out there among young Vermonters, especially in the sort of lower working class end of things.
Divestment of the state's coal and oil assets was another thing that he called for. Now, this kind of puts State Treasurer Beth Pearce in a catch-22 position. Her charge is to make as much money for the state's pension fund as she can. We also heard from Greg, who wants to know, why is this suddenly such a popular issue? So let's start with you, Paul. Why does he go after these coal and oil assets now? And what's Beth Pearce going to do?
Well, this is, you know, the way that he described this is part of his long-term push for combating climate change. It's a real shift, though, for Governor Shumlin, who just as recently as I think it was September or October of 2014, reiterated his opposition to this. He said that it would be better for the state to have a seat at the table as investors. And that has all along been Treasurer Pierce's view. She just came out with a statement today actually saying that she did not think that divestment is the, quote, appropriate strategy for our fund and is counter to our fiduciary responsibilities. That's very interesting because, I mean, I've not seen Treasurer Pierce and Governor Shumlin separate from one another like this. So don't know where this will go. It certainly was received well by Bill McKibben, the very renowned environmentalist who lives in Middlebury, or in Ripton, I should say, who's in the audience. And McKibben and Shumlin have tangled on this in the past when Shumlin has been resistant.
I want to talk about one more issue before we leave State of the State. Supporters of marijuana legalization got to think that this is an important year for them. They have a somewhat pro-pot governor in his final year, but he did lay out some tenets that he wants to see in any bill that comes his way. So, Ann Galloway, will we see a bill pass this session with the provisions that he asked for? This is probably the year for it if it would happen.
Well, I think that's right. The question is whether or not there's anyone in the House and the Senate who has the kind of political fortitude to carry this thing through. The House Speaker and the Senate President Pro Tem have basically said, "We'll air this. We'll listen to the debate. We'll let it happen." But I'm not sure that either one of them is willing to carry it over the finish line. So I think there is, you know, some question about whether or not politically it's viable, depending on what they come up with. The governor in his speech said, you know, we got to ban edibles. We got to make sure that pot doesn't end up in the hands of kids. We got to strengthen law enforcement. We've got to make sure that the taxes on it are low and any revenues that we get from it go directly into treatment for drug treatment. So I think there are some lessons to be learned from Colorado, and people are a little bit nervous about it. And the fact of the matter is that this is a very complex piece of legislation. And in both the House and the Senate, you're looking at five or six committees, you know, that they're going to have to go through to get this thing through.
Dave Graham?
House Speaker Schaff Smith was asked about it this week, and he said it's not ready yet. And when Schaff says that at the beginning of a legislative session, I think that's close to bankable because he has so much influence over his House members, and he also has such a close reading of the mood of his House that I think, you know, I would bet on him being right that it's not going to get across the finish line this year.
Ann Galloway, Dave Graham, Paul Heinz, they're here with us today to give great insight and perspective into the hot news topics from this week. Still time for you to join in the discussion by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We're going to talk about the Norm McAllister vote and the legislature's priorities over the next few months just ahead. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Bob Kinzel, and I'm joined by Dave Graham, a reporter for the Associated Press, Ann Galloway, founder and editor of VTDigger.org, and Paul Heinz, political editor and columnist for 7 Days. This is a reporter's roundtable where there is no shortage of topics to talk about this week. Let's go to this one. The Vermont State Senate voted 20-10 on Wednesday to suspend Franklin County Senator Norm McAllister, who's facing several charges, including sexual assault. In the debate, Chittenden County Senator Philip Baruth spoke for suspension, saying that the Senate needed to act.
But the question remains, why do we have to do anything at all? It's my own personal belief that the number and the nature of the felony charges against Senator McAllister requires us to suspend him, period.
All right, Paul Heinz, why did the Senate feel that they had to take this step, that they had to do something the first time, I believe, that a state senator has been suspended?
Well, yeah, that's right. I think that just as Senator Bruth said right there, many senators just felt that these accusations were just so serious that they had to take some sort of action. And the other reason that Senator Bruth mentioned several times was that any other workplace would do the same. Police officers, teachers accused of similar crimes would be suspended, maybe not fired, but certainly put on leave. So he said that the Senate should not be above that. And in the end, 19 of Senator Bruth's colleagues agreed with him on that. They were not able to summon the political will to actually expel Senator McAllister, which was an option that was contemplated through the summer and the fall. Mm-hmm. And Bruth said this was sort of a middle course that they were taking.
There was a counterproposal by Senator Peg Flory. So, Ann Galloway, what was her idea, and why didn't it get any traction?
Well, she felt that the Senate should wait until the trial was completed and a verdict had been announced before the Senate took action. And I think that people felt that Senator Bruth's arguments made more sense given the seriousness of the charges and the fact that some of the things that came out were from a conversation that Senator McAllister had over the phone with one of the alleged victims. And I at the end of the day, her arguments didn't sway the Senate.
We got a note from Andy who writes, though I don't live in Franklin County, if I did, I would feel disenfranchised. Though the Senate was dealing with a difficult situation the best they could, they left Franklin County residents without their 2 seats in the Vermont Senate, though the state constitution ensures them that representation. Is there a lawsuit in the near future? Dave Graham, where do you think this goes?
Well, I've asked Senator McAllister about that repeatedly. Obviously, he would be an obvious plaintiff in such a lawsuit. He says he doesn't have any intention of filing one, in part because doing so is an expensive process, and I'm sure he's already feeling the legal bills from his criminal case. In addition to that, he had said, intimated anyway, for weeks that he had some constituents who were expressing an interest in filing suit that, we as constituents in Franklin County are not getting adequate representation. He's now saying that essentially it sounds like they're backing away for probably the similar reasons because it's an expensive process. I think there's an extra element here, and Senator Bruth did mention it on Wednesday, which is that one of the alleged victims of Senator McAllister had worked for him as a state house intern or an assistant of some kind. Very young woman who, as of this past year, was 20 years old. He's 64. I think a lot of people were really troubled by that, and also by the power dynamic between a sitting state senator and some young assistant or intern or whatever. So Baruth got up and he was talking about the sort of in loco parentis almost aspect of being a senator, with all these pages and interns and very young assistants around, and also, you know, young people who are maybe in their 20s or early 30s who are in a, what he called, a service role to the senators. They work for the legal staff, the legislative council, it's called, or the or they work, you know, just any, really anywhere in the building. I mean, you know, the legislators are basically sort of mini kings and queens who get followed around and asked what we can do for you, you know. And so there is that power dynamic, and I think he felt like the Senate had a special responsibility on that front as well.
And Galloway, what's next for Norm McAllister?
Well, he intimated in conversations with reporters that he would still consider – that at this point he might even consider resigning. I mean, that was something that came out, although he said that he had never had sex with the intern that David just mentioned. So it's really unclear what's going to happen. He's been suspended, so he cannot take a seat in the Senate, and his trial date will be set sometime in March. There's a status conference in early February, and the jury is to be selected February 9th.
And Dave?
One more thing on the caller's question about representation of Franklin County residents. You know, that was addressed in the Senate the other day, and some of the counterargument was that you know, Senator McAllister, if he were to resign, the governor would immediately appoint a replacement for him. The representation problem would be solved. And so, the idea was trying to pin the fault for this lack of representation on Senator McAllister's unwillingness to resign. So, I mean, that did come up and it has been discussed. You know, whether you buy that argument or not, I guess it's up to whoever's listening to it.
All right, time to break out our crystal balls. Let's look at the legislature in this session ahead. Paul Heintz, what do you hear as issues or bills that will really come forth during this session?
I was hoping you were going to go to Ann Galloway first so I could just copy her answer. But, you know, I think several of the last years, it's all going to be about the budget. We have a massive budget deficit that the legislature is going to be looking to fill. A lot of that is being driven by increasing Medicaid costs. So I think that most lawmakers are going to be really focused on that. You know, at the same time, there is going to be this shiny object of marijuana legalization, which should occupy the attention of the press at the very least, and probably the public. But I think it's really going to be a dollar and cents game this year.
Ed Galloway, now you can copy off of Paul.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Now she'll have something smarter to say.
No way. I think that you're going to see the paid sick leave bill get through probably this year. It seems like the way is paved for that.
It's already passed by the House. It's now with the Senate, correct?
Vice versa.
Yeah, that's right.
No, it starts in the Senate,
right? It's going to start in the Senate,
yeah,
and then go back through, you know. And the governor said he would sign it. I do think that Medicaid is going to be a big issue in figuring out how to deal with either cutting benefits or somehow taking a hard look at eligibility, because we now have a lot of people who are on the rolls who may or may not be eligible because of the problems with Vermont Health Connect. The state has not been able to really review those eligibility requirements now for 2 years. So that's really a big deal, I think. And then maybe the governor's suggestion of taking a hard look at how much opiate medication patients are allowed to take after surgery, that could be a really interesting issue. And it seems like that could have traction given the level of the epidemic that's hit the state. The Ethics Commission is another issue that may have traction in light of what happened with Senator McAllister and some other issues that have come up, including questions about Attorney General Bill Sorrell that Paul has explored extensively in 7 days. So I think there are a number of issues that will make it through.
I will say that yesterday during the State of the State address, there were times where the governor sounded quite glib. You could tell it was his last speech. But when it came to the opiate problems in Vermont, he really did seem to kind of take that issue on and really have some passion for it. Dave, I'll give you the chance as well. Any issues or bills that are hiding out there that we're going to hear about?
Well, just to clarify on paid sick leave, I did have a brain cramp there for a second. It has passed the House and is now pending in the Senate.
So I was right.
You're right. I don't want anybody to go away with
that's okay.
Me having given them the wrong impression. I basically think that I have to sort of repeat what my colleagues have just said. I think the idea of limiting the number of pills you get in a prescription post-surgery is an interesting one, and it seems like it likely would have traction just because it sort of sounds on the surface as if it makes sense. Now, one question I have about it is whether, you know, there are any FDA or other laws or rules which prohibit, you know, which would tell the state you may not put these restrictions in place, that it's up to physicians or whatever. But
great question. Quickly around the horn, we're going to look at some things. What are the chances that we do give we have a marijuana legalization bill to give to Governor Shumlin to sign? First, Paul Heintz, what are your chances?
I don't do predictions. Sorry, Rick, because I'm always wrong.
You're off the show.
That's fine.
Ann Galloway?
I give it a 50-50 chance.
And how about you, Dave Graham?
Somewhere less than 50-50.
All right. And here's a big one. The folks down in Wardsboro have been priming the pump for a big push to make the gill feather turnip Vermont state vegetable. So anybody, is there an appetite in Montpelier for such an innovative and progressive bill? I'm going to throw it to you, Dave.
I don't know how you managed to turn up that kind of a question.
Oh, geez, Dave.
Not to get to the root of the issue or anything. But.
And he's here all week, folks, at the Flynn tomorrow night.
The budget address in a couple of weeks, you know, a few years ago, it was the new idea of taxing scratch-off tickets that got no traction whatsoever. Anybody expecting anything like that to come forth? Ann?
Oh, boy. You know, I can't think of, you know, maybe the funding for savings accounts for kids, just because we don't have the money. I mean, I think lawmakers would love to be able to do it, but there's a question about whether or not we could afford it.
Absolutely. Ann Galloway is founder and editor of VTDigger.org. Dave Graham, a reporter from the Associated Press. And Paul Heintz is a political editor and columnist for 7 Days. I want to thank you all for joining us today and sharing your insights.
Glad to do it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This week was a big one in politics, seemed packed with news stories. And that's the way it's been all fall at the Burlington Police Department. Officer-involved shootings, secrecy around an alleged sexual assault at the courthouse, and questions about how police handled a KKK flyer in the city. These are some of the issues that the new police chief has dealt with in his 4 months on the job. Chief Brandon Del Pozo will be our guest on Monday to look at policing in Vermont's largest city. Vermont Edition is produced by Sam Gal Rosen and by me, Rick Singeri. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening.